Welcome to HN Pod, your daily audio dive into the top stories, trends, and debates from Hacker News. I am your host, Sarah.
And I am Mike. Today is Thursday, March 19th, and we are covering the top stories that dominated the front page yesterday, March 18th, 2026. Welcome to episode 339.
We have a fantastic and slightly spicy lineup for you today. We are looking at some classic programming wisdom from Rob Pike that sparked a massive debate about game development, a very passionate rant about why everyone needs to own their own website, and a cool new open source karaoke app that accidentally started a war over dependency management.
We are also covering a deeply concerning investigative report on Microsoft's government cloud security, and finally, confirmation from the FBI director that the agency is still buying our location data to bypass warrant requirements. There is a lot of strong opinion in the comments today, so let us jump right in.
Our first story takes us all the way back to 1989. Someone posted Rob Pike's 5 Rules of Programming, and it shot right to the top of Hacker News with almost 900 points. For our listeners who might be newer to the field, Rob Pike is an absolute legend. He is a Bell Labs veteran and one of the co-creators of the Go programming language.
His rules are timeless, but they always manage to start a fresh debate. The rules basically boil down to not optimizing prematurely, measuring before you tune, and keeping your algorithms simple. But rule 5 is the one that always gets the most attention. Pike wrote, "Data dominates. If you have chosen the right data structures and organized things well, the algorithms will almost always be self-evident. Data structures, not algorithms, are central to programming."
Yes, it is the classic philosophy of writing stupid code that uses smart objects. The Hacker News comments really ran with this, especially looking at it through the lens of video game development. A user brought up Jonathan Blow, the indie developer behind the game Braid. Blow apparently used simple arrays of records for almost everything in Braid initially. He argued that the most important thing to optimize for is not speed or memory, but the years of your life required to implement the program.
That is such a crucial perspective. We all get caught up in finding the perfect, mathematically elegant algorithm, but as Braid shows, actually shipping the product matters most. There was a great technical tangent in the thread about how arrays of flat records are actually a very sane default for games. In a game, you are iterating over large sets of similar entities 60 times a second.
Right, the whole struct of arrays versus array of structs debate. A commenter pointed out that modern compilers absolutely love simple flat arrays because they can auto-vectorize the code without you having to write manual SIMD instructions. It prevents cache pollution and unlocks a lot of optimizations. It is a great reminder that sometimes the simplest data structure is actually the most performant on modern hardware, which ironically proves Pike's second rule about measuring before getting fancy.
I also loved the pushback in the comments about comparing indie game dev to enterprise software. Someone pointed out that a game is generally a one-and-done enterprise. You just need to get it out the door. But then another user countered that by pointing out games like Fortnite, Roblox, and League of Legends. Those are massive, long-term projects that probably started with spaghetti code and gave their maintainers absolute nightmares for years before they were properly refactored.
Speaking of getting things out the door, our next story is a blog post by Merritt K titled, "Have a Fucking Website." It got 863 points, and the sentiment is exactly what you would expect from that title. It is a passionate, expletive-filled plea for businesses and creators to stop relying entirely on social media platforms like Instagram or Facebook.
I have to say I completely agree with the author's frustration. The core argument is that you do not own your followers or your posts on social media platforms. They can change the rules overnight, ban you for no reason, or just bury your content in an algorithmic feed. The author argues that the internet was built on websites linking to each other, not walled gardens trying to keep you endlessly scrolling. She begs small businesses like hair salons and restaurants to just put up a simple site with their hours and prices.
As a user, there is nothing more annoying than trying to find a menu and being forced to log into a social media account just to see it. But the Hacker News comments brought a really necessary reality check to this rant. As technologists, we live in a bubble. We often say, just build a website, it has never been easier. But for a small business owner working 80 hours a week, it is actually a massive technical and mental hurdle.
Exactly. A user named Arenak wrote a fantastic comment breaking down why the gap from a normal user to a DIY website is still huge, even with modern AI tools. Normal people don't know what a web host is, how to get a domain name, or how to set up payment security. They do not have the time to learn. Another commenter pointed out that time-poor people want things done for them, not by them. That is why they default to a Facebook page. It's free, it's instant, and the maintenance is delegated to a platform they already understand.
It is a blind spot for developers. One commenter literally said, just register with GitHub, create a repository, turn on GitHub pages, bingo. But to a tattoo artist or a cafe owner, those instructions might as well be written in alien hieroglyphs. However, there was a really cool technical solution proposed in the comments. A developer mentioned using Noster as a backend for a blog. Imagine if a cafe owner could just post a quick update from their phone on a Noster client and have it automatically sync to their own custom domain. It bridges that gap between social media ease and actually owning your platform.
That would be the dream. Until the independent web's user experience gets that seamless, we can't really blame small businesses for choosing the easy walled gardens.
Our next story is actually a perfect example of how building software for end users can get incredibly messy. It is about an app called Nightingale, which is an open source karaoke app that turns any song on your computer into a karaoke track.
The technology behind this is seriously impressive. It uses machine learning models to isolate vocals from instruments locally on your machine. And then it uses WhisperX to transcribe and align the lyrics word by word. It even has real-time pitch scoring, so you can sing into your mic and get rated. It is basically a self-contained party game built on modern AI audio tools.
It sounds like a blast, but the Hacker News thread completely derailed into a heated debate about how the app is packaged. A user downloaded the source code to build it, and they were shocked to find that the application automatically started downloading its own executable binaries from the internet, like FFmpeg and a Python interpreter, instead of just using the ones already installed on the user's system.
Oh man, the dependency drama was real. The original commenter was horrified. They said the build script was trying to install Docker containers just to build a desktop app, and the app itself was dumping runtime dependencies into the user's home directory. They called it a security and performance nightmare. Another user complained about how common this is becoming, mentioning an AI tool that secretly installed Node and NPM on their machine without asking.
But a lot of developers jumped in to defend the creator. They pointed out that software like Blender and Krita have bundled their own Python runtimes for years. Relying on whatever random version of Python or FFmpeg a user happens to have installed is a literal nightmare for developers. You end up spending all your time debugging weird edge cases because a user has a broken system configuration.
It really highlights the tension between strict system hygiene and the just works philosophy. One commenter noted that this might be a case of vibe coding, where the developer used an AI assistant to write the build scripts, and the AI just did whatever it took to make it run on the author's machine without considering Linux packaging best practices.
Someone joked that the complaining user had just discovered static linking and welcomed them to the eternal debate of tabs versus spaces. But honestly, for a karaoke app aimed at a general audience, bundling the exact dependencies it needs is probably the only way to ensure it actually runs. Most people just want to sing with their friends. They don't want to troubleshoot Python virtual environments.
Moving from local software to the cloud, our fourth story is a deeply concerning investigative report from ProPublica. The headline is, "Despite doubts, federal cyber experts approved Microsoft Cloud Service."
This story is wild, Mike. We are talking about Microsoft's Government Community Cloud High, or GCC High. This is the suite of cloud services intended to hold some of the most sensitive data for the Justice Department, the Energy Department, and the defense sector. According to internal government reports from late 2024, the federal cybersecurity evaluators at FedRAMP literally called Microsoft security documentation a, quote, pile of shit.
You do not usually see that kind of language in federal compliance reports. The reviewers said Microsoft failed for years to fully explain how it encrypts and protects sensitive information moving across its servers. And you have to remember the context here. This review is happening in the wake of two massive cyber attacks involving Microsoft products, including the Russian hack of federal agencies and the Chinese infiltration of senior government email accounts. But despite all these glaring red flags, FedRAMP authorized the product anyway.
The reason they approved it is the scariest part. It was not because Microsoft fixed the issues or finally provided the right documentation. It was because federal agencies were allowed to start using the product while the security review was still ongoing. By the time the reviewers realized how bad the documentation was, the technology was already deeply entrenched across Washington. They basically felt they had no choice but to push the approval through.
The Hacker News comments really zeroed in on this dynamic. It is the ultimate vendor lock-in strategy. If you can get your foot in the door and get your software running before the security audit is finished, you become too big to fail. It becomes a political nightmare to rip your software out of a dozen government agencies, so the auditors just rubber stamp it.
The comments also brought up how utterly broken the FedRAMP process is for smaller companies. One user called FedRAMP a Palantir tax. Basically, getting FedRAMP certification costs millions of dollars and takes years of dedicated compliance paperwork. It completely prices out small startups and forces them to pay massive premiums to deploy inside existing approved enclaves owned by big defense contractors.
So we have this system that creates an insurmountable barrier to entry for innovative startups while simultaneously giving a free pass to a tech giant whose security architecture reviewers literally called a pile of shit. It is security theater at its worst. And speaking of Microsoft's enterprise software, there was a hilarious thread complaining about Entra ID, their identity management system. One user said there are 12 ways to enforce multi-factor authentication, 20 ways to disable users, 50 conditional access variables, and after configuring all of it, their colleagues still could not log in.
The infinite redirect loops on Microsoft login pages are a shared trauma for the entire tech industry. But it's a lot less funny when you realize this is the infrastructure securing our national secrets.
Our final story today ties right into these themes of government overreach and data privacy. TechCrunch reported yesterday that the FBI has resumed buying Americans' location data from commercial brokers, and FBI Director Kash Patel confirmed it in a congressional hearing.
This is a massive deal. The Fourth Amendment is supposed to protect us from unreasonable searches, meaning the government needs a warrant to track your location. But the FBI and other federal agencies have found a very convenient loophole. Instead of demanding the data from tech companies with a warrant, they just pull out their credit cards and buy it from commercial data brokers.
Senator Ron Wyden called it an outrageous end run around the Fourth Amendment. When he asked Kash Patel to commit to stopping this practice, Patel refused. He just said the FBI uses all tools to do their mission, claiming it is consistent with the Constitution. It is a legal theory that has not really been fully tested in the Supreme Court yet, but they are taking full advantage of the gray area.
The Hacker News discussion on this was incredibly insightful, especially regarding how this data actually gets collected in the first place. A user named Flatline broke down the supply chain perfectly. It starts with consumer apps, like random weather apps or games, embedding advertising software development kits. Those SDKs feed your location into real-time bidding ad exchanges. Surveillance firms sit in those exchanges and harvest the bid request data, even if they do not win the ad auction. Then they sell that data to aggregators, who turn around and sell it to the government.
It is an entire ecosystem designed to dissolve accountability at every single layer. Every middleman in that chain can just shrug and say they are only passing along commercially available data. And nobody is actually verifying if the consumer ever meaningfully consented to their location being sold to the FBI.
Another commenter pointed out that Apple and Google are quietly facilitating this entire ecosystem. They take a massive 30% cut of App Store revenues, claiming it is to ensure security and vet the apps. But they allow these data harvesting SDKs to operate freely. They have the power and the visibility to stop these brokers at the operating system level, but they don't. Because the ad-supported app ecosystem is just too profitable for their bottom line.
Some users pointed out that custom operating systems like GrapheneOS are the only real defense against this kind of tracking, but that is way beyond the technical ability of the average smartphone user. Until Congress passes something like the Government Surveillance Reform Act that Senator Wyden is pushing, which would require a warrant even for purchased data, our privacy is essentially up for sale to the highest bidder.
It really makes you think twice about tapping allow when a random app asks for your location. Well, that's a slightly terrifying note to end on, but it is exactly why we need to keep paying attention to these stories and having these discussions.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us for episode 339 of HN Pod. We really appreciate you spending part of your day with us.
If you want to dive deeper into any of the articles or comment threads we talked about today, make sure to check out the links on Hacker News. We will be back tomorrow with more of the top stories and debates from the tech world.
Have a great day, everyone, and keep building.